Welcome to In Their Own Words, the audio memories of leading members of the British Tennis Journalists Association. In this edition, Barry Flatman, tennis correspondent of the Sunday Times and Express, explains the significance of the Manchester suburb of Didsbury to British tennis writers and recalls memorable Davis Cup travels.
Didsbury, yes, Didsbury. Well, there was an infamous Davis Cup tie against Romania at Didsbury back in the... You'd have to look it up, but I can't remember, but... And we looked to be in a position. Jeremy Bates was playing Radzan Sabal, and Jeremy Bates was winning something like 6-love, 6-love, 4-love, and looked to be in a position of complete unbeatable. And Mike Dixon said to me, "What happens now? Who do we go forth and play?" And I said, "Hang on a minute, yeah, let's get this over with first." And lo and behold, Jeremy Bates lost in 5 sets, and hence the term Didsbury, because we were sitting in that glorious Mancunian leafy suburb of Didsbury watching one of the greatest British tennis debacles of all time. And after that, nobody amongst the ranks of British tennis journalists was allowed to pontificate about the benefits of victory until it had actually taken place.
And of course, I suppose you want to point out that this was actually on grass in Manchester as well.
Grass on the lawns of the Northern Tennis Club, Didsbury, on the southern skirts of Manchester.
Now, you also got taken to some very interesting places, particularly in Africa. And if I was to say a Davis Cup tie in Ghana, what memories does that bring back for you?
The most hilarious trip that I ever went on in my journalistic career. It was a laugh from start to finish, and mostly because of the British captain, David Lloyd, and his view of the opposition, who were African, obviously, in Ghana. And also, David was there with his brother, John, who was a Davis Cup coach. So the two of them together. John didn't trust foreign food at all. So the trip started off with John taking a big bag of British food, even though John hadn't lived in Britain for something like 25 years, but British food, and it broke. So all of John's stuff was covered with Marmite and that sort of thing. And it only went downhill from there.
Now, I know that the facilities weren't fantastic and the traveling...
Well, the hotel was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Beachside luxury.
For the tennis, though, and David had some comments to make, which took place as the travelling lawn tennis officials were actually trying to smooth things over. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Well, yes, yes, yes. What happened was that we had this guide called Ebenezer, and he was supposed to smooth everything out for the British team. And he didn't smooth too much, really. And we're in this meeting. Oh, no, it wasn't a meeting. It was a cocktail party. It's fair to say a cocktail party with the British press and the British tennis hierarchy with the Ghanaian tennis hierarchy. Not players, officials. And we were aware that something was boiling up, but we carried on into this meeting. And then we're sitting there, and Malcolm Gracie, the then chairman of the Lawn Tennis Association, was showing around the pictures of his grandchildren. And then the door, big wooden door, slams open. And there is a sweating, red-faced, clearly very annoyed British Davis Cup captain, who then shouts in front of all these Ghanaian dignitaries and British dignitaries, "Where the f*** Ebenezer?" And it transpired that David's annoyance had been provoked by the fact that we didn't have any practice balls. And it just went on from there. And David was incandescent with rage. And in the end, had to be calmed down and taken to a darkened room to just regather his composure. But David and the Ghanaians didn't get on from that moment on. And well, probably before that, because David had tried to get the tie moved and had tried to offer financial benefits to the Ghanaians of having the tie played in Britain. and the Ghanaians wouldn't have it, and they wanted the mother country to come to Ghana and sample what Ghana could offer.
Now, the ultimate in the Davis Cup is obviously to win the final, and you got to experience that as a British tennis journalist in not the most salubrious of surroundings. It'd be right to describe it as a large hall in Belgium, wouldn't it? But what an amazing occasion for you to be present at.
Yeah, well, it was like an aircraft hangar, really, Chris. It really was, and it was cold, and it was really unimpressive in Ghent. But the town was very nice. But yes, it was astonishing, really, to witness it. Having lived through the days when we got beaten by Romania at home and struggled against Ghana away, and several other dubious Davis Cup results. Obviously, the Murray brothers had a lot to do with it. Andy was supreme that weekend. Jamie played his part as well. And a young Kyle Edmund came into the team. So all in all, but the Murray brothers as a doubles team and Andy playing heroic stuff as a singles player is a vision that will last forever, I think.
And where do you see the Davis Cup and the Fed Cup? It's really fallen, isn't it? Do they have a future, the Davis Cup and the Fed Cup?
Well, the Fed Cup is no longer the Fed Cup, and it's now the Billie Jean King Cup. I'm sceptical, I have to say. I think what they have done to the Davis Cup and the women's competition, the Fed Cup, whatever you want to call it, hasn't exactly been a wise move by the International Tennis Federation. They got sucked in by a big sponsorship deal, which maybe hasn't quite worked out the way they would have liked it to work out. And it just doesn't have... Whereas the Davis Cup final, you know, the year that Britain won it, it built up and built up and built up during the course of the year. Now, I couldn't even tell you who played in last year's final. It just doesn't grab the public's imagination in the way it did.
But it used to be very different, didn't it?
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, it was help when Britain being contenders. That helped it on. But you know, even before that, the British press, you know, in the years of Hemman and Rosetsky, you know, we had some great trips. I remember Greg nearly starting a riot in the Ukraine. We went to some interesting places. And, you know, going back even further, Jeremy Banks and Mark Pesce.
And in terms of British tennis writers, Barry, there's always been a strong contingent, hasn't there, from the very early years, some very strong personalities who gave Britain an influence probably off the court that at times was much stronger than the players had made achieving on it. Would that be fair?
Well, yeah. I mean, John Parsons, we don't want to speak ill of the dead, but he was a self-appointed ombudsman of tennis around the world. And what he wanted, he usually got because he just pestered them to get his way. I'm not close enough to it to know what really goes on now. But I don't think the British press has quite the same profile as it did in days of yore.
Was that because there were more British travelling, even though we didn't have that many players? Were there more British journalists given the opportunity to go and travel the world and therefore were constant, if you like?
Well, I don't know if that's the case because, you know, there were only three of us, I think, that went to Ghana. But I don't want to say there were more personalities then, but it just seemed that we were prepared to put our foot in the door and not take no for an answer. In those days.
Of those personalities, when you started, John Parsons was obviously one of them. Can you give a sort of flavour of some of the other sort of major personalities who were there in the British tennis writers when you were operating as a youngster?
Yeah, well, I mean, David Irvine of The Guardian was a great travelling companion, very funny. And he didn't know he was funny all the time, but, you know, after the fourth glass of wine, he was hilarious. And then going back even further, there was Lance Tingay, there was Laurie Pignon, Nigel Clark, all very different people. Nigel Clark and Lance Tingay couldn't have been more polar opposites. But it was a time when everyone mucked in together, and I wouldn't say we all got on, but it was interesting times.
And in terms of British players, can you just sort of give an idea of how important it was to have Tim Henman, Greg Rosetsky, Andy and Jamie, and then later Joe Konta, in terms of getting space in the paper?
Yeah, well, the tennis correspondent became a major player in the newspaper, whereas back in the days of Bates and Pecci, we could be out of the French Open before the first bottle of Beaujolais was opened at lunchtime on the Monday. So that could be over very quickly. And, you know, let's not beat about the bush. Andy Murray has been probably Britain's, well, he would rank alongside Beckham, Rooney, Botham, Atherton, that sort of thing, as a major British sporting presence. And that's borne out by the fact that he won the BBC Sports Personality of the Year a couple of times. You know, you don't win that if you're a shrinking violet.
And it was important, wasn't it, for tennis writers to have this presence in the papers, because as travelling became more difficult in terms of costs, justification for travelling was much easier when you had players like this appearing in finals and getting to semi-finals of Grand Slams.
Yes, and the other thing was that there wasn't wall-to-wall television quite then. It was televised, but I don't talk to them about it, but I don't think that really with Amazon Prime and not so much Sky anymore, Sky was there then, but you could... Now, the sports editors and the accountants, the bean counters in the journalistic office, have come to the realization that you can cover a tennis tournament by not being there. And that, to me, is a very, very dangerous thing and a sad thing as well.
Because going to the tournaments allowed you to get to know these players like Tim and Greg and Andy and Jamie and Joe. And you met them when they were very young, didn't you? You got to know Tim very early on, and he's remained both a friend on and off the court, hasn't he?
Yes, that's true to say. And Greg in a different sort of way. And that was a very interesting dynamic, you know, those two, because they just didn't like each other. And in fact, I used to ghost Tim's column in the Daily Express, and he was giving his views on Greg. The column started off, "Greg Rozetsky makes me sick." And I said, "Look, Tim, I better read this to you before it goes." So I said, "The first words are, Greg Rozetsky makes me sick." And Tim said, "Yep, that's fine. That's all right. That's about, sums it up." And we went on from there. But, you know, they were a very interesting partnership. And then, of course, the Murrays became very interesting as well.
Do you fear that ability to get close to the players is now something that anybody coming into the tennis journalistic world is going to struggle to get to? The ability of you just to walk up to Tim and have a conversation, not about tennis, because he trusted you and you'd been to all the major tournaments where he'd been, and you were a regular face like so many of the key journalists.
Yes, to a certain degree. I mean, with the Murrays, it depends what nationality you are. And if you're a Scot like Stuart Fraser is, then he has the ability to get on with them, whereas other people might struggle a bit. But no, back then, you know, you used to sit next to them on the aeroplane. You know, that would never happen now. You'd struggle to even be on the same aeroplane as them. But it, you know, things move on. I'm sure, you know, you do a lot of rugby. Is rugby the same as it was 25 years ago?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's all behind press barriers now.
Yeah. Yes.
So if I was to ask you to pick out a couple of favorite Grand Slam memories, Barry, I'm sure that Andy will feature in some of them, but there will be others that you've been lucky enough to experience. Where would you go to pick out those special moments?
Well, the most special moment, I think, for all of us was that Sunday afternoon at Wimbledon when Andy won for the first time. But there was also Andy's first Grand Slam title at the US Open. It was on a Monday night. We all had to sort of rush around, change our travel plans at the last minute. I can remember after he won, driving back into Manhattan on the bus, and there was a Hell's Angels convention in New York City. And suddenly the bus carrying the British press was surrounded by, it must have been 100 Hell's Angels on the big chopper motorbikes. And it was sort of reminiscent of a stagecoach being held up by a bunch of Red Indians. nerve-wracking time, I think it's fair to say. But we got there and we managed to drink till dawn after it, so it was all okay. The French Open, yeah, we had some real hoots there. Not so much because of the tennis, but they used to have a thing called the Beaujolais party on the middle Saturday. And a certain journalist, I better not name him, but he was quite a prominent British journalist, was found hanging onto the railings outside Roland Garros in a state of total inebriation because he'd been rather too keen on the Beaujolais.
Australia became a fun place to go to, didn't it? They worked hard to make it welcoming for those who made the journey down to Australia. And it's a fun tournament, isn't it?
Yeah, except that now night play has just taken over everything. So every match of any consequence would take place about 9 o'clock at night, to start at 9 o'clock at night, which kind of played havoc with the social whirl of it all. But, you know, we were there to work, so work we did.
We've spoken about Andy's victory there at the US Open, but you're also sitting there when Sir Alex Ferguson appeared in a press conference with Sean Connery.
Yes, that was... very funny. We're sitting in the front row, and then all of a sudden we hear this thumping of the door and a sharp intake of breath. And Andy looks down and sort of, oh no, and shakes his head. And in walks Andy's mum, Judy, who'd obviously had a glass or two, with Sir Sean Connery and Sir Alex Ferguson, who had probably had more glasses than Judy had had. We were told, just carry on. And you know, Fergie, who was never that keen on press conferences in Old Trafford or anywhere else, was heard to say, I'm going to enjoy this. And Sean Connery was doing his level best to hold Judy up. And yes, it was some memory.
And then Andy greeted his mother with the immortal words, you've been drinking.
yes, which was abundantly clear. It's fair to say it was abundantly clear.
Would that rank as one of the most unusual moments of your tennis career?
Yes, probably, yes. But there were plenty. You know, Ghana was pretty unusual. There were several.